Today is Monday, June 19th. We're going to wrap up blood vessel information and cover the lymphatic system today. Okay, so if you want to follow me in your course pack, I'm going to start you back on page 58. We're going to look at bulk fluid transport. What we're talking about, and we're talking about fluid exchange at capillaries. We're not talking about diffusion of oxygen and CO2 across this capillary wall. We're not really talking about waste products or nutrients either. All we're focusing on with this discussion is how fluids get exchanged across the capillary. The second thing I want to mention is, why the capillary? Why are we not talking about exchanges at, say, an artery or a vein? And what about the construction here? What are we looking at in terms of the walls? Permeable walls, yeah. And they are made up of tunica, intima, right? Only a single cell layer thick. That's just simple squamous tissue. So being thin-walled makes it easy for all these exchanges to occur, and especially for filtration and reabsorption to occur. So we're looking at blood flowing through this image here from left to right. That tells me our arterial end is at the left side and the venule end is at the right side. Okay, and we're looking at two battling pressures. We're looking at a pressure that pushes fluids and we're looking at a pressure that pulls fluids. Which is your pushy pressure? BHP, good. And like I mentioned to you last week, don't have to memorize the numbers here. If they stick and help you out, then that's great, but I'm not going to ask you what BHP is at the end of artery or vein end. It happens to be a pretty healthy push at 35 millimeters mercury, and because we have a semi-permeable capillary, it's easy to push these fluids across the wall due to a filtration pressure. By the time we reach the venule end of the capillary, we're looking at 15 to 17 millimeters of mercury, so the pressure does decline a great deal. All right, so that's our pushing pressure. What is the pull pressure? BOP, good. And the catch is, it is a stable 26 millimeters of mercury across the entire length of our capillary. Alright, so let's review which one of these pressures is based on salts and proteins in the bloodstream. BOP, good. So salt and protein pull fluids toward the higher concentration. So a higher osmotic pressure is going to attract more water to the salt and the protein. The hydrostatic pressure, by contrast, has really nothing to do with the salt and protein in the fluids. Rather, it is simply fluid-based push. So fluids in the capillary are going to push against the walls of these vessels. So we're pushing at the arterial end with 35, and we only have a pulling ability of 26 millimeters mercury. And like we talked in class last Wednesday, the higher pressure wins the battle. So are we pushing or pulling at the arterial end?
Pushing,
yes. So BHP is the winner. We effectively push fluids out first into the interstitial space. That is a type of extracellular fluid, okay? And if we accumulate fluids in that extracellular space, the next place we can travel into is your intracellular fluid. So what does it take to qualify as edema? Yeah, excess in the interstitial space. And if that fluid happens to reach your cell and make your cells bloat, then that's a separate issue. So we've got actually two potential issues here. We can make your interstitial fluid space swell, and ultimately we can make your cells swell as well. So down here at the venule end of your capillary, because we've pushed so much fluid out, we have lost BHP, and now we've got an imbalance for BOP is going to be your higher pressure. So the osmotic pressure is going to pull fluids because it's based on salts and proteins, and it's going to win the battle. What happens to fluids in your interstitial space?
Pull
them back in. Good. And of course, the name of this process is?
Reabsorption.
Reabsorption, good. The easiest access is to pull your interstitial fluids first back into your capillary. So you pull from that location first, and when you pull that area to a hypertonic state, then you can actually start pulling fluids out of your cells back into the interstitial space and ultimately back to the capillaries. So the process of returning fluids is pretty efficient. We're looking at around 90% of the fluids that we push getting reclaimed. What happens to the other 10% of the fluids that we don't reabsorb? Good, so the lymphatic system is going to pick up those escaped fluids. And lymphatic vessels aren't actually too very far from any one of our capillaries. They're going to be sitting in this interstitial space picking up those escaped fluids. So I want to make sure you're comfortable with this concept before we go any further, because the lymphatic system picks up on this concept. Some things to make sure you know. Which pressure is responsible for filtration?
BHP.
Good. That's your pushing filtration pressure. Which pressure is responsible for reabsorption?
VOP.
Good, because it pulls fluids back into the capillary. Which one of our pressures is based on water in the bloodstream?
BHP.
H stands for hydrostatic, so that's your water-based pressure. And which pressure is essentially the same exact thing as blood pressure?
BHP
once again. Good. What is BOP based upon?
Salt.
Yes, salts or solutes and proteins. And they, in fact, create pulling power to attract fluids. Okay, so the process of pushing fluids out into your interstitial space is known as?
Filtration.
Yeah, that's known as filtration. And the process of returning fluids to the venule end of your capillary?
Reabsorption.
Good. So let's talk about edema one more time. If you happen to have too much hydrostatic pressure, and if it exceeds your osmotic pressure, does that send more fluid out or pull more fluid back in?
Push more out.
So yeah, if you have blood hydrostatic pressure greater than blood osmotic pressure, you have what's called edema. That's excess fluid in that interstitial space. I'm trying to think of the test and make sure I hit all the main points on there for Wednesday. So that's kind of the routine we cover right now. We actually build on this when we do fluid electrolyte balance later on, so we'll come back and redo the entire topic in chapter 25. All right, how about questions? Do you feel good about this topic? Do you feel pretty solid? Okay. Anything I can address before we take a step further with lymphatic system?
Okay, when you have edema, can you go over that? I think I'm writing down something.
Okay. So if you have edema, this is your push, your BHP, and that BOP is your pull. And if you're pushing more fluids out than you can pull back in, then you end up accumulating fluids in your interstitial space that you don't reabsorb into the capillary. So they hang out, they call swelling, and that's interstitial space. Okay.
Do you have your recording on?
I do have my recording on, yes.
That's a really good little,
it's
all packaged
circuit. I'll have to crank up the volume since I'm standing this far from the computer, but yeah, it's on there. There's something on your worksheet called net filtration pressure. I just want to make sure I mention that before we keep on moving. And if you notice, let's see where we should look. Page 58, look at your picture down below. Wednesday, we talked about hydrostatic pressure in the interstitial space, and we talked about osmotic pressure in the interstitial space. And I mentioned to you that these were actually very little They're very low pressures. They're less than 1 millimeter mercury. And we're not going to really pay much attention to them because they have such a low number. They don't really have an overall influence on the push or pull. Okay, so let's do some math for a minute and you'll see what little influence they have. If you think about the net filtration pressure, we're looking at the overall ability to filter fluids out of your capillary or reabsorb them back in. If we're looking at a push of 35, that's a positive pressure pushing out. Mm-hmm. If you look at a pressure of 26, that's actually a negative pressure coming back in. So if I say 35 minus 26, that gives me 9 millimeters difference, right? And then you say, okay, well, if you tell me the net filtration pressure is 10, where do you get that extra 1 from? It comes from these two pressures in the interstitial space. So I know initially the math doesn't look like it works properly, but 35 minus 26 is 9. Take into consideration about a millimeter difference out here, and that's how we get an overall push of a positive 10 millimeters mercury. Okay? So that's what we mean when we say net filtration pressure. Our ability to push is about 10 millimeters. If you thought that was bad math, this is even worse, okay? Because down here we have around 15 to 17 that we're pushing out with. We're still pulling back in with a negative 26. Since the 26 is a returning number that's pulling the fluids back in, then we're going to have an overall net negative number here because that tells me we're actually pulling, not pushing fluids. So if I take the difference between, say, 26 and 17, and then take into account the 1 millimeter or so in the interstitial space, that's how I end up with around a negative 8 pulling pressure to come back in. Okay? Big picture here. If I'm pushing out with 10 and I'm returning with negative 8, there's where you see that we're not actually reclaiming everything we pushed out, right? Mm-hmm. That tells me that I'm leaving a little bit out here in the interstitial space. Had we pushed out with 10 and had we pulled back in with negative 10, then there would have been nothing left for us to pick up with the lymphatic system. Makes sense? Mm-hmm. Okay. So just by looking at the net filtration pressures, I think we can get an appreciation for we're leaving something on the table here that the lymphatic system has to pick up. Okay, so the only numbers that I would say are good to know are your net filtration pressure numbers. We're going to use these throughout the remainder of the course when we talk about filtration and reabsorption. Anything about this topic? Any questions from page 59? Any parts you'd like to hear again? Not initially, right? Because the primary influence is over the BOP and the amount of pulling power you've got. Okay.
Yeah. One of the tests on the question, in one of those practice tests, was saying something about the BHP in the interstitial space, I thought.
It would increase actually your OP in the interstitial space, which would increase the pull out to the interstitial fluid. But that's a touch on what we're going to cover when we get to 25, too. So we'll probably go into more detail with it when we get to chapter 25.
Okay.
Yeah. Sometimes when I have a 15-week semester, I'll go into a little more detail. In the 10, sometimes I'll trim out those details, and then we'll get to them, but just in a different spot.
Okay. That was just confusing me.
Yeah, it's weird because it's going to actually decrease your osmotic in the capillary and increase osmotic pressure in the interstitial space. Is there anything else I can help clarify for you? Was that it? Okay. How about rest of y'all? Any other questions on that stuff before we keep on moving? Okay. Why don't we go ahead and look at lymphatic, and then if you have questions about blood pressure regulation or anything else, we can go back and cover that. By the way, I'll probably need to go back and do page 60. Don't let me forget. I'm gonna skip it for right now, because this next thought is a complete continuation of where you're at with this stuff here. So let me take you over to page 62. In this class, we actually don't cover immunology or immunology. We don't cover the immune system. If you all take microbiology, you'll cover immunology there. We actually do cover just a piece of this lymphatic system, which is often tied in with that immunology and immune system. So our focus here for the lymphatic system is to be kind of a pickup crew for the escaped fluids from your cardiovascular system. And we just talked about the fact that fluids get pushed out and may not get reabsorbed back into the venule end of your capillary. So if you're picking up all these escaped fluids, this is a fantastic time to clean them before they rejoin blood circulation. So that's why this system also plays a role in immunity. So I want to mention this issue about water one more time. If water is in your bloodstream, we call it plasma. If water is in between your cells and tissues out here, we call it interstitial fluid. What about water inside your cells?
Intracellular
fluid. What about water in the lymphatic vessel? Call it lymph, yeah. So in fact, what lymph is just water in a different location. And it's picking up plasma that escaped from your blood vessel. It's picking up escaped or excess interstitial fluids. And once it's inside this lymphatic vessel, well, we changed the name and now it's technically called lymph. So it is a clear, colorless fluid. It's not the color of blood, because where are red blood cells supposed to stay? Capillary, yeah, in the bloodstream. So this lymph stuff that's out here should be a clear, colorless fluid. It should not be red. It shouldn't be yellow or white like pus either, even though it may house some white blood cells and even some blood proteins. So the issue about filtration is that we can push fluids out of our capillaries, and the filtration pressure may be so strong that we also force out some plasma proteins like albumin. And the catch is, your lymphatic system can pick those proteins back up, whereas your blood capillary cannot. So that's a big deal. If your blood capillary can't reclaim its own proteins, what pressure are you going to affect there?
BOP,
yeah. So your lymphatic system says, hey, it's okay. I'll let them ride in my system, and then I'll eventually dump these back in the blood flow. So ultimately what's important is you pick up those escaped plasma proteins, and you ultimately return them back to blood flow. That way you can maintain your pulling power of blood osmotic pressure. So we don't often think about what an important issue this is, that we're not just picking up escaped fluids, but we're also picking up those escaped proteins. All right, so we've talked about this issue here. I do want to show you that on a lot of these models, they'll color the lymphatic vessels green. They're trying to avoid confusion with red arteries, blue veins. You know, they color nerves yellow on most of those models, so green is the choice of colors for our lymphatic system. One thing I want to make here is the lymphatic system is a one-way system. They are all closed-in vessels flowing toward the heart, okay? So we're not circulating anything here. This is a drainage system. It is a one-way system that picks up fluids and returns them all back to the heart. You already have a circulatory system. That includes your arteries, capillaries, veins. This is not a system to circulate fluids. So you're not going to hear us talk about lymphatic arteries, but you may hear us talking about lymphatic veins. In what direction do you think they carry fluids? Back to the heart, yeah. So just like a cardiovascular vein, a lymphatic vein is doing the same thing. Actually not there. They're going to both join into the subclavian vein. And then from there, the blood and the lymph travel back into SVC and back into the right atrium. So a little different flow path there from blood. So since these are thin-walled vessels, just like the cardiovascular veins, and since we are taking fluids under no pressure and trying to work them back to the heart, we have to have some aids or things that can assist us with returning lymph, just like we can need help getting the blood back to the heart. So we need a muscular pump, meaning your leg muscles, your arm muscles, your physical movements will help to milk the flow of lymph and blood back to the heart, as well as breathing. And then vessels, these larger ones, are going to have smooth muscles to help milk along the flow of not only lymph, but also blood in those cardiovascular vessels. So this should sound really familiar. Does this sound like the assist that an artery needs or a vein needs?
Vein.
Vein, yeah. So cardiovascular veins and lymphatic vessels have a lot in common, and they both need help getting that fluid flow back to the heart. All right, so let me show you lymphatic capillaries for just a moment. You'll notice they're tangled throughout the cells that are served by a regular cardiovascular capillary bed. They are closed-ended, as you can see here. They're not circulating fluids. They're just picking up fluids. So, you ever been to the beach down there at Main Myrtle, maybe out on the boardwalk? Okay, or even in the mall, the shopping mall here in Florence. When those stores are open, they're going to prop their doors open because they want you to see inside, they want you to hear their inviting music, and they want something to catch your eye and have you come in. You know, how many of us see something and see a closed door and say, oh, maybe they're not open yet, or I don't want to worry with it, and you just don't bother opening the door. So lymphatic vessels are the same way. They want to make it inviting and as easy as possible for lymph flow to return to the lymph vessel. So these little collagen fibers right there are like door props. They prop open the lymphatic vessel doorways. They're called mini valves. And that encourages the flow of lymph from your interstitial space back into that lymphatic vessel. And so I kind of think of it like this mad evil subway design. The doors open, you hop on, and then the doors close. And you're trapped. And where are you going? To the heart, yeah. So the whole goal here is to invite you in. And once you're inside as lymph fluid, the doors relax and they close. The pressure is now going to be maintained by having closed valves. That sounds familiar, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so close the valves and then trap the fluid, and then you're on for a ride. So that's how these lymphatic vessels get the fluid to come in and trap it in there. They open the doors, then close them immediately after pressure starts to rise. So yeah, they're all tangled throughout lymphatic, or rather cardiovascular capillaries. It's a way to pick up those escape fluids and route them back to the heart. Okay, near the bottom of your page, this is on page 62, by the way. What do you think would happen to lymph if there is a blockage in a lymph vessel? It wouldn't go to the heart. Yeah, and it couldn't, I heard one of you say rupture. It could, in fact, make that vessel rupture. And the bottom line is that fluid would not get back to the heart. Okay, so the bottom line is that fluid would not get back to the heart. Okay, so if you can't return that fluid back to the heart, how does that influence your cardiac output?
Decreases it,
exactly. And so we're talking about cardiac output because it is the number one influence on
blood pressure,
exactly. So if your cardiac output has decreased, so has your blood pressure. And are we talking specifically about BHP or BOP? BHP, yes. So blood pressure and BHP, blood hydrostatic pressure, are the same thing. They will both decrease if you don't get that lymph back to the heart. So the whole goal of returning this fluid back to your heart is to get it into circulation, and that way we can rejoin and circulate this fluid back as blood plasma once again. I'd like to show you the drainage pattern. I've notated it on the top of page 63 for you. There is actually an asymmetrical drainage pattern here. I'm gonna hit the lights just long enough for you to see that there's a color difference here. You'll notice the right side of his head, right arm, right thoracic cavity are all colored a light green color. That's because that particular region of the body drains separately from the rest of your body. You know, normally when we talk about flow patterns, we're talking about a symmetrical left and right side flow, but not here. It's kind of an oddball flow pattern. The right head, right arm, right thoracic cavity all drain into a duct on the right side. That duct ultimately rejoins with your subclavian vein. And then the one on the left side picks up fluids from your head on the left side, left arm, left thoracic cavity. Looks like a good deal of the abdomen, and actually both legs drain back on the left side. So here's what is absolutely crazy. Instead of just calling them lymphatic ducts, they've got a different name for the left and the right sides. So you'll notice over here, they've notated on the right side, it's called a right lymphatic duct. This picks up fluids from this shaded region, and those are dumped back into the right subclavian vein. Okay, if this was somebody normal naming it, I would have guessed the other side would have been called the left lymphatic duct, right? Okay, not the case. The one on the left side is called a thoracic duct, and the left subclavian vein receives those fluids, and that's left side of the head, left arm, left side of your thorax, abdomen, and both legs. Why couldn't they pick the same name? Okay, so nonetheless, right lymphatic duct dumps into the subclavian. Thoracic duct is on the left side. It dumps also into a subclavian vein. Okay, so you may know about surgical shunts that are placed in. People may receive medications directly into the blood that way. That requires less poking and prodding than having to constantly access a vessel, right? So the subclavian vein is used to being a dumping ground for blood coming back from the head. It is also the place where the lymph from the entire body rejoins blood flow. So it kind of makes sense that those are used as shunt points for a port being placed into those vessels. So it's a great place for us to quickly get stuff into the blood flow. So subclavian vein, that is the location for all the lymph of the body to rejoin blood flow. What do the subclavian veins dump blood into and lymph? Back into the heart, yes. So ultimately the SVC, and then back into the right atrium, and now we've rejoined with regular blood flow. So this is a great opportunity for us to clean the lymph, and the next thing you'll notice are the lymph nodes. What is the problem with returning lymph that contains bacteria back into the SVC and right atrium? Infection, yeah. So what may have started out as an infection in the hand has now traveled to your heart, and now where can it go? Body, yes. So we now can have a condition called sepsis, which is like a blood infection. So we don't want to transmit all this infection all over the body. So how do we prevent it from being spread? We have cleaning stations known as lymph nodes, and they're scattered every so often throughout our loose connective tissues. And they're a great way for us to remove bacteria, viruses, cancer cells before they hit the heart and travel systemically. There are certain types of white blood cells housed in these cleaning stations called lymphocytes. You may recall that they are B cells and T cells, and they're very specific as to what they fight. So if you've had the flu virus travel through a lymph node before, and it's the same exact flu virus as you have an antibody built for, you can stop it before it ever gets further from that point. There's actually lymph nodes all over your entire body, but there's three primary locations where they're collected. They are in the chin area around your neck here. They're about an inch long, and they feel like a little kidney bean. I don't necessarily encourage you to squeeze up underneath there, but I'm sure you felt them when they've been swollen. They're at the back of your neck. If you've ever had a horrible head cold, you may have had the neck area hurt. And you can even feel little kidney bean or jelly bean shaped structures. Those are the lymph nodes back there. So, of course, cervical lymph nodes clean whatever is contaminated coming from your head in the lymph down toward those subclavian veins. Where are axillary lymph nodes located?
Armpits,
good. And they're cleaning lymph coming from where?
Arms,
yeah. And then we also have a set of inguinal lymph nodes. They are found around the groin area. And what are they cleaning lymph coming from?
Legs,
good. I do want to show you in this picture, there are lymph nodes along the aorta here. They're close to the central part of your body. So we don't just have cervical, axillary, and inguinal lymph nodes. They're scattered anywhere you've got a large number of vessels to pick up these escaped fluids. So here you can see collections of lymphocytes. Their job is to tag and get rid of any kind of foreign invaders, and also to create immunity so that if we see them again, we're already loaded with a set of antibodies to kill and, you know, stop the infection before it starts. So I'd like to show you how a typical lymph node is set up. You notice that we've got a number of vessels bringing lymph into that lymph node and a few vessels leading away. Afferent vessels are coming into the lymph node. Efferent or efferent has an E that reminds me of the exiting vessels. So compare the numbers here. We've got twice the number of afferents coming in as we do efferents leaving. That's no mistake. So what does that help us do? Clean the lymph, yeah. Imagine a toll road, right? Toll roads have 20 lanes coming in. They want your money. They make it very easy for you to drop off your money. And then after you've paid your fee, what do?
Back down to two.
Oh, we got your money. Who cares, right? Now there's two lanes leaving the toll road. That's exactly what happens here. It says to the lymph, oh, hey, come on in. And then it says, oh, well, who cares if you can get out or not? The whole point is to let us have time to clean. So this lymph has to meander its way through these trabeculae and eventually make its way out. That gives us plenty of time for macrophages to eat bacteria and lymphocytes to build immunity or antibodies against that stuff. So a cool thing you can see in this picture, inside your lymph node, there are tiny little chambers or rooms. These are separated by fibrous capsules called trabeculae. What advantage do you think they serve? Could increase surface area. Okay, that's one thing. What else could they be doing for us?
Trapping
it. So if you have an infection in this chamber here, it may not reach the neighboring chamber or the farther chambers. So it's a way to maximize your space, to make sure that you kill whatever it is, and to not let your entire lymph node get damaged. Okay? So if you happen to have sore, swollen, painful lymph nodes, what does that typically tell us?
There's an infection.
Yeah, it normally comes with colds or headache, or not headaches. That'd be awful if you had swollen lymph nodes for headaches, wouldn't it? But yeah, infections, things of that sort. So they'll swell when they're fighting. The time they say to be worried is when you have swollen lymph nodes that are not painful. That could indicate other things going on, such as cancer residing in those lymph nodes. So swollen, painful lymph node simply tells us they're usually fighting some type of infection. All right. So you've heard of the plague, right? Killed millions of people throughout our human history. You know what the plague black oozing sores are? Buboes, yeah. And those are the lymph nodes that are actually swelling with bacterial infection and rupturing. So. Yeah, and they actually still have cases of the plague nowadays, oddly enough. All right, so what I'd like to take you through now is page 64. These are some lymphoid organs. Do you remember the suffix OID? Like or resembling, okay? So these are organs that are partly in the lymphatic system, and they also serve other functions. So some of these are going to play double duty in other systems. Inside these lymphoid organs, you'll notice that we've got macrophages, we've got lymphocytes like T cells and B cells, and it is their job to provide some type of immunity for our body. So these are contributing to the immune system and immunology and helping us from getting infected, preventing that from happening. So let's take your spleen first. It's on the left side of your abdominopelvic cavity. It is a membrane-wrapped organ. And I make that point because if you rupture the membrane, what happens to the spleen? It ruptures, yes. So you have to take it out. So it's like taking the shrink wrap off a product. You know, now the product's been exposed. And in the case of our spleen, it has to be removed. So we can function without our spleen. Do you know which other organ takes up the jobs? Liver. Yeah, the liver takes up the main jobs. So the liver and the spleen have a lot of similarities. You'll notice on your worksheet, I've underlined some of the primary functions. Notice that the spleen cleans the blood. Not to be confused with your lymph nodes. What do they clean? Lymph nodes clean lymph. The spleen cleans blood. Okay, so two different functions there. Lymph nodes clean lymph. Spleen cleans blood. So you'll notice that we take out things like bacteria, viruses, even worn out and old blood cells are removed by your spleen. We also call your spleen a reservoir in case you need it for, say, a hemorrhage. If when you're hemorrhaging, you're losing blood, and your spleen says, hey, I've got some stored blood, I'll give it to you. So we can put those blood cells in circulation and help to maintain oxygen by having the spleen donate those blood cells to circulation. So that's why we say the spleen is a reservoir, because it's storing the breakdown products of red blood cells. It also stores platelets, which is good for helping us in case of a hemorrhage or a vessel that's been ruptured. All right, so that's one of our lymphoid organs. Another is called the thymus. Where is it located? Good. Under the sternum, it's right over the heart. And at what time of your life is it most active? Good. And what is the name of the hormone that it makes? Good. Thymosin. And the types of cells it programs are called? T cells. Good. So here's an interesting thought. If your thymus gland begins to atrophy in your late teenage years, and you no longer have a way to program T cells, but T cells are important for fighting infection, how do you continue to program them? Good question, huh? Okay, so another T location, your tonsils will actually take up the job. So if you've had, you know, your tonsils removed, all three tonsil sets, then now you've got more issues. So, you know, back in the 50s, 60s, they were big on taking people's tonsils out if you had a couple of sore throats. And nowadays, you keep them unless you've got kissing tonsils that are rubbing at the back of your throat. So they now know that tonsils are really important for helping to program T cells after that thymus gland has atrophied and dried up. Speaking of tonsils, I think this is kind of cool picture to show. It's actually an incorrectly drawn picture. It was in a textbook for many years, and then I guess they finally got wise and changed it. So we've got tonsils scattered around the opening of our mouth and nose. If you open and say, ah, which set can you see at the back of your throat? Palatine. Yep. Palatine are in oval-shaped pouches on either side of your throat. If you could possibly stick your tongue out far enough, you might see another set at the base of your tongue. Linguals, good. And none of us can see our pharyngeal tonsil. Where is it located? Pharynx, right. So you'd have to look through your nose. It sits on top of your soft palate, and it's alternately known as adenoids, right. So there are not six tonsils. There's two palatine. There's two more lingual, so that's a total of four. And there's one pharyngeal tonsil. So there's five total sets of lymphatic tissue, not six as they've shown in this picture. So good talking point to be able to illustrate that the adenoids are in fact not a set of tonsils. It's just one big mass sitting up on top of your soft palate. If you happen to have your tonsils removed, what they'll typically do is called a TNA surgery, tonsillectomy and adenoidectomy. They'll take out the palatines on either side, and they'll take out the adenoids sitting on top of your soft palate. Why those? What are they blocking?
Airway.
Yep. So most likely they're gone because they block your airway. So they're great for filtering out pathogens coming in through the air and the food coming into your mouth and nose. So that's another good reason to hang on to them unless they cause, you know, a blockage of your air pathway. All right, last but not least are your patches. They're called Peyer's or Peyer's patches. They're kind of like tonsils, and they're sitting in the lining of your small and large intestine. So you'll notice in this picture here, there's pieces of lymphatic tissue. They're built in there to help you avoid getting bacteria into your bloodstream. You know, how many of you have ever been sick off of something you ate? Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of us, right? So if you're thinking about eating something that perhaps has been sitting on a buffet for many hours, there's a great possibility for bacterial growth. This is one stopgap in preventing that bacteria from making its way into your bloodstream. So once it gets in the bloodstream, we know it can travel systemically. All right, I do want to introduce something called MALT, very bottom line there on the bottom of page 65, MALT. These are some types of lymphatic tissues that are in the mucosa. Tonsils are part of MALT. Peyer's patches are also MALT. And then one we don't cover in this chapter, but we will later on, the appendix is also part of the MALT system. We're going to hit the likes for you just for a moment. So this is not fat. This is actually fluid. It's called lymphedema. And the case here is involving proteins from the plasma that have escaped. Normally, we say that the lymphatic system's job is to pick up those escaped fluids and those plasma proteins, take both back to the heart so it can rejoin blood circulation. Well, unfortunately, if you have a blockage in your lymphatic system, you can't pick up those escaped plasma proteins. They are now hanging out in your interstitial space. So does protein influence hydrostatic pressure or osmotic pressure? Osmotic, right. And if you put proteins in your interstitial space, what happens to the fluids in your interstitial space? They're going to follow. Yes, so they stay there. So that's what this is. Do you think a diuretic would help somebody in this situation? No. Not really. Yeah, they're not terribly effective. That may be what they give them, but ultimately you're having to pull fluids from the interstitial space back into the capillary, and you're fighting that osmotic pressure from those plasma proteins hanging in the interstitial space. This is also lymphedema. It happens to be because a woman has had her breast removed, and along with it, they took some lymphatic vessels. By taking the lymphatic vessels, we now have no way to get the fluids back to the heart, so it looks like this left arm here is swelling greatly. So they have sleeves that you can wear that increase the pressure from the outside. They put pressure on those vessels to pick up the fluid and hopefully transmit it back to the heart. Otherwise, you're left with a really swollen appendage, in this case, an arm. We should be very thankful we do not live in certain parts of the world, but I don't know, with global warming, they may be coming to us. This is a tiny parasitic worm called Boucheria, and it lives in the yellow portions on this map. So typically, you can see this is around the equator belt of the world in some of the more moist environments. This particular worm happens to be involved in a life cycle with, guess who, mosquitoes. And, of course, the life cycle involves us as human beings. And if this mosquito bites us with the larvae of Boucheria, then the larvae get into our bloodstream and they start reproducing. Now, unfortunately, what happens is those larvae grow into worms. Those worms hang out in our lymphatic vessels. So you can see very clearly, upper body looks okay, but from this point down, she must have had blockages somewhere in that inguinal area that prevents all those fluids from coming back to the heart. Same thing here. This leg had a blockage. This leg is normal. Okay, so again, this is not fat. It's just excess fluid that's stuck in the interstitial space. If they can take an antibiotic, it will kill the Boucheria worms and help to reduce some of that swelling, get that fluid back to the heart. And then so it can be stuck anywhere. This is a set of men with Boucheria in their scrotum. It can block the fluids coming from the testes back to the heart. So, yeah. All right, so as promised, a very short chapter. Yeah.
I do have a question.
Sure.
What page is the effort? The
for the vessels and the lymph nodes? Let's see. I would look at the bottom of page, 63.
63?
Yeah. Look at the very last bullet point on the bottom of the page. And there it explains afferent comes in and exits via the efferent. Would y'all like to go ahead and take a break? Okay, and we can come back about 2 o'clock, and then we'll just kind of go from there when you come back from break.